go.
Okay.
Before you turn it on.
Okay.
So I'm going to talk to you about the stuff you sent me. I want to talk about the list of names.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Because I would like to take some names out and add some names.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
One of my responses was that there's no... None of my graduate students.
Okay.
I had a lot of, in fact, being in a medical school, I had a lot of postdocs.
Yeah, yeah.
So I was going to take out Dudek and Murphy, who left the field.
Yeah.
And then I want to say a couple things about Hank Fales, maybe.
Sure.
Or somewhere mm-hmm. else. I mean, shall I tell you the names, or do you want to...
Well, no, I think if you got the list on your copy, then that's, we'll, you know, we can, when we get to that part of the interview, we go ahead and use your list, and that's good.
Okay, so...
Let me put this in here.
Whoops. If that's flexible.
That's fine.
Names you were familiar with, or something.
Yeah, well, I worked with the bibliography list, and with SciFinder, you can get a number of, you know, listed by frequency. So I saw all the people with whom you'd had so many papers published.
Yeah, that's a very sensible.
So I thought that would be one way to get the list started. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, obviously, if you want to do some others and then chain drop them, that's not a problem.
Sure.
So.
Okay. Well, all right. Mention a couple of graduate students.
So we'll go ahead and start off by saying that this is April the 13th, Friday the 13th. Mm-hmm. I'm at University of Maryland College Park in the biochemistry building with Professor Catherine Fenslau, and we're going to begin a little oral history interview of her career. And so we usually start these wonderful things in the very beginning, and try and remember if you can that we'd like to also get the specifics about who, what, where, when, how, and why. So particularly dates are a bit nice to be able to tie things down to. I'll be probably pounding on the keyboard occasionally because I'm creating a word list for the transcriptionist who doesn't know all this stuff.
Yeah.
Well, I don't multitask too well. So, back in the beginning, it looks like you grew up on the West Coast.
No, you know, I grew up in Nebraska.
Oh, my. Another Nebraska person.
In fact, 25 miles from Fred McLaughlin's wife.
Wow, that's amazing. That's interesting.
I'm sorry, is there
talk to Sarah.
That's interesting. The Midwest seems to be a fairly good resource for people going to science.
Or for people leaving the Midwest.
Leaving Nebraska, yeah. So this was on a farm? Or
no, it was a small town, about 6,000 at the time. It was the county seat of an agricultural county.
And you went to... School there, your undergrad, your high school and grade school education was in a small...
Yes, in York, Nebraska, named after York, Pennsylvania.
York, okay, very good.
Settlers who came west after the Civil War.
And these, your parents were, what was about their background or level of education? Were they...
My mother's grandparents emigrated from Wales.
Okay.
Settled in Iowa, and the Welsh have, you know, a millennium-long tradition of culture, and my mother was educated through college and also played the violin very well. She eventually had master's degrees in music, in Spanish, and in librarianship.
Oh, boy.
And she came to York to teach in the small college there and to teach violin.
Oh.
And my father was born in York, and he also had a degree from the University of Nebraska, and they met at that time.
Oh, okay.
During the Depression, when my mother got married, she was told she would no longer have a salary, but she couldn't continue to work.
Great. So was she working, what was this, did you mention the school that she was?
Well, it was called York College.
York College, okay.
Yeah, you know, after the Civil War, colleges sprouted like apple trees all over the country.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, it's interesting that there were so many land-grant colleges that came into being over that period after the Civil War. And so...
including this one, by the way, University of
Maryland. Yeah. Well, Cornell, and they're all over the place. So I imagine then that your home life was pretty rich in terms of intellectual encouragement and enrichment, and in terms of you know, getting your brain to function and do something besides. You know.
I think that's fair. Sure.
Yeah,
and there were two children, and we were both daughters, and so they say that fathers with no sons, you know, encourage their daughters to act in their to do some of the things boys do. So,
we've
got lots of encouragement.
And the environment around York, was it more? I guess it was primarily a farming community for the most part.
Yeah, there were 71 people in my high school graduating class, but six of them went on to MDs or PhDs.
Oh wow.
Yeah, so you know, there was a good gene pool.
Yeah.
After the Second World War, people were given opportunities for higher education.
Yeah, yeah. So somewhere along the way, you decided, with all the intellectual possibilities out there, that you thought science and/or chemistry would be something that would be fun to do or interesting or.
Well, certainly science. We took a lot of family trips every summer. We went west or north. I loved the archaeology at Mesa Verde National Park, and there was a lady ranger there. I really wanted to be an archaeologist, and she said, oh, you may not want to be an archaeologist because they won't let me go out in the field and dig. I have to stay in the museum and categorize. So I said, well, I'll find some other kind of science. Now, she was wrong because, you know, when I got to Bryn Mawr, I found there were women archaeologists digging in Greece. And
sure.
But in any case.
They wouldn't let her dig.
They wouldn't let her dig. And
maybe there was a reason for that.
So I looked over the rest of the sciences and thought that chemistry was the most interesting.
So this was a fairly conscious decision.
Yeah.
It wasn't.
Well, and, you know, catalyzed by Sputnik.
Oh, yes. Okay.
And there's a whole generation of us who were encouraged and then supported by the government after Sputnik.
Yeah, yeah, indeed. And so were there any teachers in high school, or is there any individual that you can recall who put a little bit of a bug in your ear, or you just decided?
I liked my driver education teacher.
Okay.
Well. The science folks were really, really tried hard, but they didn't necessarily. I mean, I came to this enthusiasm independently.
Okay, you weren't inspired by any of them.
They were good, but not
inspirational.
Were, yeah.
Okay.
And I also thought I had an excellent history teacher, an excellent English teacher. You know, it was, in fact, as a point in time, these were teachers, women teachers who felt like they lost their potential husbands in the First World War.
Oh, okay.
And so they were very good teachers, overqualified. And it was just a nice time to be in a public school.
It's an interesting phenomenon. I was sitting on a session, or actually it was Wednesday, at the Chemical Heritage Foundation, where they're talking about trying to create a virtual chemistry set. So they had everyone there talking about what experience they'd had with chemistry sets. And the president of CHF made an interesting comment. He says, there are some people who are just dedicated to being scientists, just in their genes, and you know, other people get inspired, but apparently you're one of those persons with whom that was the thing, is you really wanted to get into the
some
science.
Some kind of science, yeah. I also had a chemistry set, but I think that they didn't provide very good instructions. I can't remember ever using it. One of those blue ones everybody had. But my father had a mysterious wooden chest in the basement that he called his chemistry set.
Oh, yeah?
And it had lots of things in it that weren't in the in my FDA-approved chemistry set,
right.
Including a recipe to make stink bombs.
Okay.
So.
Well, did he ever make any? Or?
No, I made one.
You made
one. Took it to school.
So, all right, so did this make an impression on anybody?
It did, but they never identified the perpetrator.
Now we know. We can go back to York College.
This is the York High School. Yeah, this is the first time I've talked about it.
Quite interesting. But this is, you weren't inspired by the chemistry set to make the stink bomb. You were inspired by the things your father had squirreled away.
That's right.
Was he a chemist?
The homemade chemistry set.
The homemade chemistry.
Yeah.
I was wondering, well, maybe was he doing a little home brooding? No.
Not that I could tell from what was in the set. But that would have been from his when he was a youth, which would have been.
So that would have, that was really very early chemistry set, yeah. Which. Yes, well, obviously today's chemistry sets are pretty, how would you say, tame,
I think. Sanitized.
Right. So you got away with this little escapade, which now is, we'll all know about it. So you'll get a chance to clean it up if you want. So then you decided that you wanted to go to college. You went to York College, is that correct?
No, I... Well, with a mother who was a professional teacher, and Sputnik, and all of the government's interest in higher education, I was able to look further away.
Okay.
And I glanced briefly at the University of Nebraska, decided that the Greek system was too strong there, and applied to a number of Seven Sisters colleges.
Uh-huh.
A family friend who had, in fact, graduated recently from the University of Nebraska told me that if she had it to do over again, she'd go to a Seven Sisters college.
Oh, okay.
So I applied to three of those, and then I applied to Stanford. So that's both an East Coast and a West Coast ambivalence, and in the end went to Bryn Mawr,
okay.
Which is, you know, in the Philadelphia suburbs.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. And then I did get to go to Stanford for graduate school.
So did they? Were you able to get in, be accepted in the various seven of the schools that you did apply to, the sisters, the different ones?
Yeah.
So it was a matter of your choice then?
I can't remember which ones I applied to, beside Bryn Mawr and Stanford, but those are the two I finally chose between.
Okay. What happened during
your... I had to take the SATs.
Oh, okay.
And they were not widely given in Nebraska, so we actually had to drive 100 miles in Omaha to take them. My parents drove me.
So, but they did have that, that was in, I'm guessing, 57?
Yeah.
56, 7, 8,
probably, I've graduated.
So those were enforced by then, I guess, the SATs.
Well, for the colleges I was looking at,
yeah.
They were required.
Okay, this was a requirement. So when you reached Bryn Mawr, this was a kind of a little bit of a culture change from the West. So how did you adapt to that?
I loved the science. And I worked hard, and I tried to figure out all those very large houses built out of elegant Wissahickon schist, and tried to party in Philadelphia as much as I could. So.
And well, that's good.
I bet you can have trouble spelling Wissahickon schist.
Well, I got the schist part, but how do you spell wicked?
I'm not sure I know either. We'll have to check it out.
I'll check it out. W-I-C-K something, Wickenhicken. We'll try that, and I'll find it in some. So what kind of a curriculum did they have in chemistry?
At Bryn Mawr?
Actually,
a very proud curriculum. The chairman of the department was a man named Ernst Berliner, who had been a Louis Fieser student. And Louis Fieser was the famous Harvard organic chemist who taught at Bryn Mawr for a couple of years, married one of his students named Mary, and of course Lewis and Mary Fieser published a whole series of organic
chemistry. Sure, that was at the Fieser and Fieser thing?
Yes, Fieser and Fieser series.
Yeah.
So I think that he handpicked Ernst Berliner to go to Bryn Mawr, and Berliner was able to hire good faculty, you know, not a lot of faculty. They had a number of faculty wives who were the teaching assistants, so it was very classy. And they had a fair number of majors. There were probably 12 majors in my class.
Oh, okay.
And this was before women were widely admitted to medical school, so maybe 8 of those majors wanted to be chemists, and the other 4 were hopeful pre-meds.
So this Berliner fellow, he sounds like he's European. Does he come from Germany?
You have a question here about mentors, and I've had 3 wonderful mentors, and they were all Jewish immigrants, Jewish refugees in that.
So did he come from Germany as a result of the tensions that were in Germany at that time?
Uh-huh.
So he got out before things got nasty.
As things got nasty.
And the Fieser, facilitated him getting a position?
He did his PhD with Fieser at Harvard.
Ah, okay.
And so he was a student of Fieser's.
Ah, okay.
And I think Fieser took care of Bryn Mawr because his wife had, you know, because he taught there and he met his wife there. So he sent us a very good scholar. Berliner also married one of his student grads, Bryn Mawr.
Pretty common.
I think it was. It was. And stayed happily and constructively there. He was a wise man. He understood that that there was value in having a record of all the women he'd trained, and mm-hmm. he had a notebook with everybody, the locations people worked after they graduated, and that was subsequently used to obtain funding from NSF mm-hmm. when the time mm-hmm. was right.
So you're... The size of the class at Bryn Mawr was...
I think we had 170 in my whole class,
yeah.
And about 10 of those were chemistry majors.
So it would be, I guess, considered more like a liberal arts college?
Good geography, they had good archaeology, coming back to that theme.
Oh, really?
and physics there was... kind of old-fashioned, but it had very capable people doing it. I say old-fashioned because we actually did the Faraday experiment.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, which people don't even hear about anymore. So.
No. So what is that?
It's where you electrolyze a weighed amount of, I think, copper and measure the current that had to be used to transfer that mass to some other electrode, and then you can figure out Avogadro's number.
Oh, wow.
So
how close did you come, or did you...
Probably not very well.
Yes, it's always nice that, you know, these experiments that where you know what the answer is, but they don't depend on your coming up with the right answer.
That's right.
So it was a reasonably kind of a close environment, I guess. Did you have any homesickness coming out of the Midwest of the...
Oh, I surely must have missed it, but I wasn't really, like, depressed or anything.
Yeah.
We had to travel by train, so, you know, some Haverford boy would take me to the train station early to get home for Christmas, and then I'd change trains in Chicago and go on into, actually, probably Lincoln, not
sure.
Not to York.
Yeah.
And then my last year, which would have been 1961, air flight was more accessible, so I think I actually got to fly home at Christmas
wow.
in my senior year.
Yeah.
So it was distant, but it was so exciting. I mean, I sat on my front porch that last summer, summer after I graduated from high school, and said, I really want to go see the rest of the world. Really.
Well, I can understand.
Yeah, so Philadelphia was part of the rest of the world.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's a pretty big part of the rest of the world.
Mm-hmm.
So, how was tuition there? This is a private school, right?
Yeah, it was. My parents thought it was expensive. I had a fellowship, a scholarship,
mm-hmm.
and I have no idea what the price, what actually what the number was.
Uh-huh. But it was considered to be a little bit as a private school. It was probably a little pricier than
the University of Nebraska would have been. Yeah,
definitely. Yeah, yeah. But because of the scholarship, financing wasn't an issue.
I think because of my parents' wish to give me all the chances, all the possibilities,
mm-hmm.
open all the doors,
mm-hmm.
that I...
A good attitude that pervades in many families, not mm-hmm. as many as it should today. So that was pretty nice. You didn't have to be concerned with financial things. And,
right.
So this Berliner fellow was a mentor to you at the time?
I would call him one of my three major mentors, yeah.
So what did he do that impressed you?
He let me work in his lab a couple of summers.
Okay.
I also worked with a man named Frank Mallory, who was a younger organic chemist on that faculty.
Mallory? R-Y. Okay.
And they learned things from both of them. But Berliner and the whole department just conveyed to us that we could.
You know,
we could do it, we could do chemistry.
I see.
We could have serious expectations.
There was no negativity towards your being a woman entering a scientific field.
Right. I mean, that's the advantage of a women's college, right?
Well, yes, yes, yes. But, you know, science is normally considered to be, you know.
It was at that time.
At that time. Because I know from talking to Mildred Cohen in her oral history, she was, you know, resisted every step of the way in her pursuit.
She's just a decade ahead of me, maybe?
Probably. She was working for Harold Urey at Columbia in the mid-30s.
Oh, no, it's more than a decade.
So it would be almost two decades.
Yeah, well, so that would be before the Second World War, and I really think that changed a lot of things in our country.
Yes.
Plus the...
She also had the Jewish problem, that she had a lot of resistance because of her background. But yeah, it's and of course Columbia is a different place than Bryn Mawr, and as you say, they're interested in promoting. So that worked out pretty well. Were there any other besides Mallory and Berliner who were helping you out and giving you guidance with chemistry there?
There's an inorganic chemist named Joe Varimbi and a physical chemist named George Zimmerman.
I can get Zimmerman, but I'm not sure about
V A R I M B I or E M B I. I have to check it. But
okay,
one
we'll get
and
that.
And then there were, as I said, there were a number of faculty wives who also helped with the teaching. Mrs. Berliner, Mrs. Mallory.
So, but they were like tutors or did
no,
they
laboratories?
Laboratory,
yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
And so you had their full laboratory experience. What labs, organic chemists,
absolutely,
labs, and all that good stuff. Okay, so that was a full-blown, totally immersion chemistry thing.
It was a real major.
Uh-huh. Okay, so now, I mean, but did you start out going there saying, I want to do chemistry, or did you start out going there thinking, we'll stick around and I'll decide later?
No, you do know that if you are going to major in one of the sciences, you have to start
you
from the
beginning. You get
started
early, yeah.
So I went there and announced chemistry, and actually the college had a number of arts of other requirements, including proficiency in two foreign languages.
Oh, yes.
And I was able to take my German courses on campus, but the chemistry requirements took all so much time that I needed to go to summer school to learn French. So I went to Harvard Summer School.
Talked
my parents into letting me go to Harvard Summer School to learn
French. So you could pass that requirement.
Yes.
Language requirements are passé these days.
Yes. But, you know, it's been fun. I mean, they were almost immediately not relevant in science. I did read a couple of papers in German.
Yeah.
But it's been fun, though, to have some proficiency as a tourist.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that does come in handy. Mm-hmm. I can always get by reading signage, usually in Europe, but you wouldn't want to catch me in a conversation.
Yeah, that's right.
So you completed the curriculum there in pretty much a standard four-year range. Were you taking typically 18 hours?
I think it converted to 16.
16?
Uh-huh.
Okay.
But you know, lab courses are always more than
More
time
yeah.
than the hour
yeah.
credit.
Oh, sure.
Credit hours.
Yeah, yeah. And you then decided, when did you decide you already know you wanted to go into graduate school? Is that?
Well, you know, certainly at the right time, and perhaps there was more nudging there from the faculty than I realized, but I went around and talked to the faculty in the fall of my senior year about where would be good graduate schools to go. And I think that was a trickier decision because one of the schools they suggested was Minnesota, and I did not go there, but they shortly got sued for their sex discrimination record.
Really?
So it wouldn't have been a pleasant place had I gone there. I decided to try the other coast since I'd been tempted already by the left coast. And, so the Christmas of my senior year, my parents sent me to California to interview at Berkeley, Stanford, and use the very new campus at UCSD. And then I visited an aunt in Los Angeles, or Pasadena.
Okay.
And it was kind of interesting because Berkeley and Stanford both accepted me and offered me TAs. And then when I didn't respond to the TA ship at Berkeley, immediately they sent me a letter and raised the TA. But I went to Stanford, but I postdoc in Berkeley, and I learned that they need so many TAs that they and they kind of treat them like cannon fodder did at that time, and that they fully expect to fail out half of the first year class.
Yeah, yeah.
And so, you know, if on the left and on the right, there were treacherous valleys that I avoided.
Yes, yes. Yeah, that was, I guess it still is one method of staffing your graduate school with students is to take a bunch and say, let them flail around and the ones that don't make it too well then are out. What about, I don't know, we got Berkeley, what you did at Berkeley, but then the other school, UCSD, San Diego, was that?
That was a place 50 yards from the beach.
Ah, yes.
And they were just starting that. I think they took a very small class that year, so I was not accepted there.
Okay.
I'm not sure what, I didn't know that. I didn't want to be in Southern California anyway. I think it was a lot more fun to be in the San Francisco area.
Mm-hmm. And were there many other young women coming into the Stanford graduate school
there
in chemistry?
I don't know numbers or percents, but there were three or four others in my class.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wasn't alone. Not Stanford was at the tipping point. It had hired W.S. Johnson and Carl Gerasi and was about to come to hire Paul Foree and become great,
mm-hmm.
but it wasn't quite great then, so it was an interesting it was an interesting time to be there. There were, the old faculty who had been doing competent research,
mm-hmm.
and then there were these new superstars. They were layering over the old faculty.
Yeah.
So there were more faculty tensions but the graduate students had many opportunities.
So there was I want to back up just a second before we go forward. And that is, you went into chemistry as an undergraduate degree. Did you have any vision of what you would do with it when you got out? I mean, assuming...
From Bryn Mawr, you mean?
Yeah, from Bryn Mawr.
Graduate school.
So you knew you were going to graduate school? Or?
By the end of my junior year.
By the end,
I think my attitude, maybe not well formulated, but it was to do as much as I could, to have as well-developed a career as I was able to. Now, the much younger woman in this department whose office is above me says that she knew from the beginning she wanted to be a full professor somewhere, but there are other people in my generation who, like myself, didn't approach it with that much confidence.
Mm-hmm.
She said, I'm going to do the best I can.
Mm-hmm.
And that's worked out. Okay.
Oh, yeah. Right. Well, I think that's a good attitude to go forward with. Mm-hmm. And, if you use your best shot, then...
Yeah, yeah.
So you finally decided to go to Stanford, and that was, looks like a pretty good decision based on mm-hmm. the other options that you had mm-hmm. in the West Coast. And so this would have been starting there in the late 50s?
No, early 61.
61, okay.
Yeah, started at Stanford in 61.
So was that the era of the flower power and the hippy-chippy or whatever?
We were just ahead of it. I missed all the fun. So, I left Stanford in 65 and spent 2 years in Berkeley, 65-7. And the helicopter gassing on the Berkeley campus was after I left,
mm-hmm.
and the demonstration for the People's Park was after I left, and I think Mario Savio, throw me on the wheels of the machine, was all just after I left the West Coast.
I see. You missed all the excitement. My youngest son went to Berkeley, and when we went out there, sometimes people refer to it as Berserkley.
Well, I thought Berkeley was a terrific place to be a postdoc. I would not have wanted, I think it would be a challenging place to be an undergraduate because there were so many opportunities, There was the Baptist preacher on the corner at noon, and then on the other block there was the Black Panther rampant. And so as a postdoc, Berkeley was fun and interesting, but as an undergraduate,
it could have been a little
too
distracting.
Many distracting.
Yeah,
is a good word.
I think it still is, but not quite as much as it was then. I
mean,
it's a place that draws people. And so how many, you start out in Stanford, and obviously you have to pick some kind of a chemistry specialty. Are you going to...
Yeah.
Was this a choice that you had to work through, or did you have some ideas right off the top, or...
I don't think I went there with a firm commitment to organic, and I'm not sure I still that I do organic.
Uh-huh.
But as we took the, what did they call those tests you take the first week you're there, which we probably don't do anymore anyway.
Oh, yeah.
Qualifying exam.
Yeah, yeah.
That became apparent that I should not, my strengths were not in physical chemistry. So I concentrated on organic.
Yes, well, that's not exactly a wimpy curriculum.
Yeah,
organic
yeah.
is, and it's getting less so with more chemistry being discovered. So then that was a kind of a early on decision based on the fact that it looked like you were really much more qualified to succeed in an organic environment. Okay, and then so you had the... do some TA work.
Oh, that was a wonderful time. I did one semester of TA. I feel really badly that the students here have to do two semesters of TA. And I TA'd one laboratory section, and here we work them much harder. We distract them from their research, I think. But yeah, I did a little TA.
So just the one semester?
Yeah.
Okay. Probably at Berkeley you would have had to do a lot more.
It seemed that in retrospect, yes.
Yeah. So was that like an organic lab? Or were we
yes,
doing
it was an organic lab. And I remember grading homework.
Yeah.
But I don't actually remember being in the lab with the students, but I must have been. But
yeah. then you've decided to go into organic, and you're taking your regular... graduate curriculum with advanced courses, and you still have to get some PChem in, right? You can't
sure.
avoid any PChem.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And organic chemistry and anything on the inorganic side. Was there much people much interest in inorganic?
In inorganic?
Yeah.
There was very little interest in inorganic at Stanford at that time, but shortly after I left, they hired, before I left, they hired Henry Taube. Who had really reinvented inorganic and made it much more interesting. And I really did enjoy, I don't think I got to take his course, but I got to hear the seminars and realize that there wasn't just memorizing phenomenon anymore. there was a logic to it.
Yeah, it seems like it's the poor sister of the chemistries, inorganic. But I guess with solid-state sciences, maybe it's a little bit more...
Certainly strong in this department, but it merges to material science. So the most interesting graduate course I took was one that Gerasi offered, and it was called steroid synthesis. He was in his steroid phase, and but he was always tried to be very creative in his instruction, and he had each graduate student in the class write a chapter for a book.
Oh wow!
And the book was called, I think, it's something about steroid synthesis, and he got a publisher to publish the book, and gave us each a little bit of money, each of the authors, but then he spent most of the money on a small structure that was, we called the round building, that was supposed to be used for group meetings and graduate student affairs from the department. So the whole thing was very creative, the use of the money, use that format for the class. And he also offered a $100 prize for the person who could name the book.
Oh, wow.
which I did. I got that prize.
Oh.
He was often, you remember, he had come out of industry, and he was accustomed to financial incentives, and there were some other prizes just that he offered just within his own group.
Mm-hmm.
And one student from Brazil who won one of Carl's $100 prizes didn't cash the check. And finally Carl said, "You're messing up my checking account." And then the student said, "But I'd rather have your city on the check than the money." And so I think they made a deal. He cashed the check and got the canceled check.
Back.
Yeah.
So he had a, what would you call it, foreseeable future in Jurassic.
Foresight,
that he would be an important character, and his signature would be worth something. Well, maybe, I don't know, is it worth more than $100 a day?
I don't know today, but you know, he had at that point already invented the birth control pill, and so he was, and he was very prominent in natural products chemistry, and hence, for some reason, had a lot of affinity for Brazil. I mean, maybe they have good natural plants to produce natural products. So Carl had spent a lot of time in Brazil already, had a joint international program set up where postdocs went back and forth, and my colleague who didn't want to cash the check was a graduate student. So the Carl had a very strong presence already in Brazil. So this fellow from Brazil knew.
So what did you name the book?
I can't remember, but I'm embarrassed, Mike. it's on my shelf. But you know, it had to have certain words. It had to have steroids, synthesis, organic.
Well, it kind of constrains it to a large degree.
Can't
be too creative with that, I don't think.
Yeah.
Yeah, we'll have to find out, because it's worth $100.
Okay, write that down.
So he was in the habit of incentivizing the troops by offering money.
It seemed that way.
Things. Yeah. And what industry? He says he came back from. He came from industry. So do you know where he came from?
Sure. He founded the Syntex.
Yeah, but I mean, so he came after Syntex to Stanford.
Well, he.
Or during Syntex.
Yeah. Let's see. He actually spent. I think he spent a couple of years at Hoffman La Roche, but then he went down to Mexico to join. A team of natural product chemists who were trying to recreate the recipe for converting some a steroid derivative that they got out of yams to something that could be turned into hormones for the birth control pills.
Mm-hmm.
And they did succeed in it. The early part of the story is even more interesting. A fellow named Marker had developed this process, who came out of Penn State. And
this is the YAM process.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then he got, Marker was a difficult fellow, and he got mad at his little company, which was called Hormona Sintetica or something, and just walked out. And it turned out that the whole process was being carried out by uneducated folk who probably didn't know what they were doing. They'd been taught to do this step but didn't know why. So that then the company called in a team of experts to try to reconstruct the chemistry as well as the process.
Yeah.
And Girassi and some other, I think there were probably five people on that team succeeded. And the company then was reconstituted as Syntex. There's better histories of this in several.
Sure, yeah.
In one of Louis Fieser's books, and in many of Girassi's books. It was reconstituted as Syntex, must have been registered in this country. And Girassi, the company moved to Stanford Industrial Park.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm getting ahead of myself. Girassi decided to go back to academics. He spent a couple of years at Wayne State.
Okay. I remember that connection.
Probably when he launched the Brazil initiative, and then he was lured to Stanford. He convinced Syntex to relocate to the Stanford Industrial Park, where he had the double title of director of research at Syntex and professor of chemistry at Stanford.
Uh-huh.
He invented conflict of interest. He did it very well. You know all the questions with conflict of interest, and he understood them all at that time. And so far as I was aware, the science did not go back and forth. He hired some people from the university, from his lab in the university, to work at Syntex. But we were not working on projects that were of interest to Syntex and so on. And he took a half salary from Stanford, and apparently that was his time division was nominally 50-50.
So he was conscious of trying to not mix the two together and keep it.
And that was way ahead of the national conversation on conflict of interest. Several national conversations. Yeah. And as a lab director, I never felt like he was not there half the time. He had group meetings once a week. Uh-huh. I could make an appointment to see him anytime I wanted to. I did need to make an appointment. Mm-hmm. But once in a while, if I came to work late, I'd find a message on my desk that said, "See me as soon as you get here."
Okay.
You know, which is really, why aren't you here at 8:30 or whatever?
Yeah, yeah. Why aren't you being a graduate student?
Yes.
So he was definitely hands-on, even though he was half-time.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Well, yeah.
Stanford was getting their money's worth.
Yeah, yeah.
Of course, I mean, he was obviously making a bundle of Jack and the other half of his of his life.
I think he probably made the most money out of the patents.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But, yes, and he started several other companies while in California. High energy.
Yes, there's people that have that ability, very creative and able to do all kinds of exciting things and make the rest of us look like bikers. But so you were at there 5 years for years?
I did my thesis in four.
Four, very good.
And standard chemistry turnaround mm-hmm. time, yeah.
And the graduating graduate class in chemistry was running...
I think most people went through there in 4 years.
Okay, and the number of people that came out of Stanford graduate in chemistry per year is like a dozen or
I have no idea. You know, I didn't pay attention at that time to those interesting facts. Yeah.
Yeah, I was kind of curious because my son graduated from Berkeley, and we went to the ceremony, and he graduated. I don't know, 70 PhDs and 5 masters and 3 bachelors. You know, it was just a totally different mix. You know,
That's amazing.
So I was just kind of curious what Stanford was doing at that time, and in terms of how many people.
Well, if there were, you know, I have the feeling there were 18 or 20 in my graduating class, and probably 14 or 15 of them actually got their degrees. I don't know if it was 4 years or 5 years, a man named Don Hunt was in my graduate class.
Oh, right. Is this the Don Hunt of Don Hunt fame?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
And he left Stanford after 1 year and then finished at MIT.
Oh, okay. So that West didn't agree with him. I guess is he an East Coast person to begin with?
I think he's probably a Virginia
person. Yeah. So Stanford is in the Bay Area, right? I'm in the Kent. Is it?
Yes, it's 30 miles south of San Francisco.
Okay. Did you get a chance to do any of those other things that San Francisco's so well known for? You know,
did a lot of hiking. Good. Yeah, camping. Stanford is, you know, maybe the epicenter of Silicon Valley.
Mm-hmm.
These guys named Hewlett and Packard mm-hmm. came out of the Stanford Engineering mm-hmm. Department and started their company in their garage.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Well, I wonder what they would think of the company today.
Companies.
Yeah, companies. Yeah, Agilent is basically has the business they started, and everything they started has kind of been splintered up into other...
Uh-huh.
I mean, there used to be an outfit that you get good measuring equipment, mm-hmm. Frequency synthesizers and counters and all that good stuff, as well as the analytical side. But it's impossible, I think, to trace the genealogy of these companies anymore because they keep buying each other up and trading names. And I mean, what's PerkinElmer?
Yeah.
And the other interesting thing, I don't know if you saw the editorial in CNN News that both PerkinElmer and Agilent didn't go to BitCon.
I knew they didn't. I don't know if I learned it
Agilent
from CNN News.
Actually bought a booth and didn't put anyone there. It was like a snubbier, stick it in your face kind of a thing, you know.
Wow.
So I don't know whether they're unhappy with the management or what. I saw DeKalb and John Baltus the other day with CHF. I should have asked what is going on.
Agilent's making a big assault on proteomics right now, on biological mass spectrometry.
Uh-huh.
They went dormant in mass spectrometry for almost a decade.
Yeah,
but they're back with full strength with some very interesting equipment.
So this is. Well, I'm sorry, I didn't get the name of the
Agilent.
Agilent. Yeah, uh-huh. yeah. Well, that's another story that we'll get to.
Okay.
Now you have a choice Are you going to go into academia? Are you going to go into industry? Are you going to go into government? Are you going to,
okay,
you're going to get some guidance?
That's number three. You know, that was so... I saw this on your list, and I thought I never looked at it as a choice. I only looked at academia. I think being growing up in Nebraska, I didn't ever consider the government as an employer. I mean, it's a long way from the government, and... But perhaps I was always pointed by Gerasi and then by Melvin Calvin and so on, two academics. But I was married at the end of my graduate school and during my postdoctoral times, and then we looked for jobs together.
Mm-hmm.
The two career problem.
Mm-hmm. That was probably one of the earlier two career problems, situations developed.
Well, one of the earlier successful ones. I imagine there have always been, you know, like the Feasers.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And that was, I assume you did a bit of searching around the country for positions. Did you get any assistance from, like, Calvin or Gerasi in terms of...
Well, they wrote good letters,
but
Gerasi really handpicked Calvin for me.
Okay.
And handpicked me for Calvin and made that arrangement. Although I have to tell you about, you know, a fellowship I got that really was important to my career. But the next position, the first job in the universities in this case, my husband looked around, you know, mm-hmm. applied to a number of positions, universities, and when he would interview, he would say, you know, or he would let him know at some point that he had a friend who would like to move with him. And Hopkins was sincerely interested, Hopkins Medical School. They wanted to hire Alan Fenslow because he was a good organic chemist, and they wanted to, at that point they were doing some experimental tinkering with their medical education and wanted an organic, sort of what we might call now a bio-organic chemist, you know. And they also were very interested in mass spectrometry. When the strong professors in the pharmacology department had been a postdoc with Gerasi at Wayne State and, you know, firmly believed that we should be bringing mass spectrometry into biomedical research and mm-hmm. pharmacology and small molecules. If they'd done an independent search, I might not have got the job, but because they wanted, the medical school wanted to hire Alan, so they were very happy to consider me for the job.
So this was facilitated by Alan as well as by your graduate advisors, your people at Stanford.
Yeah. And the Gerasi network, if you like, and the fact that there was somebody already there who knew he needed some mass spectrometry. And
now, when you were at Stanford, you were doing mass spec, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So that when was your first exposure to mass spectrometry?
Well, that was my whole thesis project.
Okay.
I went there in the fall of 1961, and Gerasi had been reading Klaus Biemann's papers.
Sure.
And Klaus really, you know, really brought, in this country, brought mass spectrometry into organic applications. Then Gerasi invited him to spend couple months in the summer at Stanford mm-hmm. and learned everything he could from Klaus, bought a CEC instrument and hired a European. He hired Herbert Budzikiewicz, trained in Austria.
Sure, yeah.
So
yeah.
And so he was able, Gerasi was, thought this was important, put the pieces together from all over the world and then started opening the field of natural products mass spectrometry. So I was joined his lab at that time, and my thesis addressed mechanisms of fragmentation.
All right.
And then with Calvin, I also did mass spectrometry.
Okay. But so this instrument appeared during your tenure as a graduate student?
No, before I got there.
Before you got there.
Everything was
set
up.
It was there. Uh-huh. Budzikiewicz was there. Put into the position of using the instrument.
No, I never got to use the
instrument.
You
never have to put your hands on it.
This is an interesting difference between, my postdoctoral work and my thesis work. Gerasi, and I think even Biemann at that time, used the tool like they would an NMR.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was a tool to give you measurements, and then the intellectual effort went into understanding the, what the spectra said. Mm-hmm. The spectra said, and so Jirasi had maybe he had 25 to 30 people, most of them foreign postdocs. Mm. I met Japanese people, European people. Mm. I've always, and since it then, imprinted by that experience, I've always thought that was a valuable part of, feature of a laboratory, but.
Yeah, the worldwide the distribution of the people in the lab.
Yeah, and that science is international. Mm-hmm. You know, the State Department's figured that out too. In any case, so I synthesized a lot of compounds with deuterium in specified positions, and then sent them downstairs to have their mass spectra run. Then they came back upstairs, and the spectra came back, and I would figure out if the hydrogen was transferred from the alpha, beta, or gamma position, mm-hmm. And that mm-hmm. was my thesis, working mm-hmm. through four or five different
functional groups. So you never really got your hands dirty, so to speak, with
that. I never got to run the mass spectrometer. Eventually, I think Klaus's lab did evolve to be a little more interested in instrument development. When I moved to Berkeley, though, Calvin wanted me to work on practice for the analysis of the return lunar soil mm-hmm. samples. Mm-hmm. So I was doing, you know, analyzing rock extracts and things. But Bill Dalvin was there on the faculty of photochemist, and he and I did some studies where we looked. We identified analogies between mass spectrometry and photochemistry rearrangements, the so-called McLaughlin rearrangement. Mm-hmm. It's a well-known photochemical rearrangement. And then Al Burlingame, who was assistant professor, was kind of one of Melvin Calvin's lieutenants.
So Burlingame had started his career. You'd gotten out of Beeman's lab and had moved to...
He was assistant professor at Berkeley when I was a postdoc, okay. Yeah. And Calvin had 110 people in his group. He had won the Nobel Prize by this time. He had his own building. And, he was operating with about five what I call lieutenants. Mm. Very accomplished senior scientists in their own right, and several of them, including Burlingame, had faculty appointments. Mm. And Burlingame was running one of, as I understood it, one of Calvin's subgroups, and particularly funded as well. You know, that was funded that way. So I got to work with Al, and as well as with Dalvin and Calvin. Burlingame was very much more instrument-oriented. And that's the point I was trying to make, that I was, you know, there was a black box in Jirasi's lab. Al's focus was really on he didn't invent instruments, but he put things together to provide new capability. So he had a 21-110,
okay,
you know, which was the instrument,
the
highest performance instrument at that time. But he became interested in computer processing of the data. I mean, you remember 21-110? You had you had to read a photoplate if you wanted high resolution spectrum. Mm-hmm. So that cried for automation, and Al went big time into automation, and he had a small computer on site and people to program it, and we tried to, you know, various ways to process our data. I don't think we ever omitted the glass plate while I was there, but that was the objective. And I also did run my own spectra there. Had to run my own spectra.
Very good. So you really got hands on with the instrument.
So my introduction to running the instrument was in Burlingame's lab with the 21-110.
So even though you had been dealing with the mass spectra, you never with the mass spectrometer.
Jirasi was organic chemist.
That's an interesting kind of a separation. So what did you think of the 110? Did you you were doing organic compounds, so you're doing electron ionization with that.
Was there anything else?
Well, I mean, you could do the spark source organic,
right?
But,
we were doing the
EI source.
We were working with organics,
and using the photoplate.
Working with these fatty acids that Calvin thought might be biomarkers in the lunar soil samples, and they weren't fatty acids; they were alkanes, reduced fatty acids, and working with the organics from the Dalvin lab that were small synthetic organics, and working with a couple of natural products that Burlingame got access to somehow, so much of the papers, most of the papers from both labs went into Jack's, you know, because sure. it was all new and wonderful at the time.
Yeah, well, I guess between, at that time, Beeman and Terassi and Calvin, was there anybody else? Maybe Fred was dabbling in things outside of the petroleum industry. I mean, it seemed like for a long period the petroleum industry really ran
that. Morrison and Jack Sharkey. I think Fred had, I'm not sure when Fred went to Purdue, but I do know that Frank Field and Bernie Munson had begun to publish in Chemical Ionization while I was still a graduate student.
Oh, really?
And Gerasi, in his characteristic manner, you know, got them out to learn what they had to teach. So I heard about that pretty early.
That's interesting, though. I mean, of course, Gerasi came from an industrial background, so he probably didn't have any qualms about bringing people from industry
in to talk. Right.
But, you know,
as
I mean,
you point out, half the field was in industry.
So bringing the guys from a humble oil and refining.
chemical ionization.
But it's interesting because when talking to those gentlemen during these interviews, they pointed out how much those industries actually brought in very high-powered academics to talk to their people. And something that's not done today, at least in my knowledge, particularly in the petroleum industry, but you know, they brought in, I think Herbie Brown came and talked to Cy Marson's people, you know, when he was up at Standard Oil of Ohio and all this kind of, they were really this great exchange. It's just an amazing intellectual concept of what happened then and doesn't happen today in the industry. So there was a kind of a back and forth between, I mean, Gerasi was willing to bring people from industry who had something valuable to talk to the academics and vice versa.
I have no idea if Gerasi consulted for anybody besides Syntex because, you know, as I said, he was a professor in my presence and not a...
Yeah. Interesting. So actually, did he bring out both...
No, he brought Frank.
Frank out and, to talk about... Frank could have talked about it in Baytown. It could have hurt him. And that huge booming voice, I don't think that's, I'll ever forget that.
But he was a smart guy, and, you know, Gerasi knew a smart, respected that.
Yeah. So that's pretty neat. So let's see, you got through the graduate school curriculum in like 4 years, pretty much, and that was a successful thing. You'd gotten married, and so you went into, you did some postdoc at Berkeley. That was a dual career type thing. Then did that work out?
Yeah, but that worked out partly because Gerasi made sure it did.
I mean,
Alan had. As an organic chemist, coming to bioorganic chemist, went to work with Daniel Koshland, was a postdoc with Dan Koshland, who was in some way associated with the Levi Strauss company, a San Francisco family.
Okay.
and then Gerasi spoke to me. Became aware that Calvin could use a mass spectroscopist and made that happen. But Calvin wasn't willing to give me a salary. And I don't know if that's because he didn't have the money or because that was his standard approach to postdocs, you have to bring your own money. And so many people from Europe, for example, did come with government funding. So it was very, very critical, and you have this question in your outline somewhere, to my career, that I was able to get a modest funding for that postdoc, the first postdoctoral year. And that came from the American Association for University Women.
Okay.
And they had a small fund, I think it's a much, much larger fund at this point, for supporting female, not just scientists, and maybe not even mainly scientists, but scholars.
Uh-huh.
So,
I mean, were you aware of this organization before you came to the point where you wanted some money?
No. I think my mother's best friend from college was very active in the national structure of the American Association for University Women and was keeping track of me and you know, said, why don't you think about applying to this fund? And I did get it. I may have been one of the first scientists who they funded, and that got me into, you know, I could go to Berkeley then, and then Calvin liked what I did and funded me the second year from his NASA.
So you had a little guardian angel there to help you out.
Well, I don't know, or just a connection, or, you know, if it hadn't been that one, then probably would have been something else, but that's the one that came through.
Is that organization still operational today?
Oh, yeah, okay. Yeah. So AAUW.
AAUW, okay.
Yeah, they do a voter, anyway, I think they do voter information.
Mm-hmm.
And they still have this fund for scholarships for female scholars. Good. Fellowships for female scholars.
So that got you into Melvin Calvin's lab. That's kind of a tough act, though. I mean, you had to come with your own funding. That's
well, I think I was a big boy, right? And and I think many of his postdocs did, and many postdocs did at that point, at that time.
Of course, I mean, you know, it's also worthwhile to you in your career to be working for a guy like that. So,
yeah.
You know, I mean,
yeah.
You can
figure
out how to do it one way or the other. Borrow
right,
some money.
Right. Well, and it was also a good experience to be. I mean, I was work nominally with Calvin and, in fact, more with Burlingame,
mm-hmm.
which was also a valuable experience.
So Burlingame was probably not too far in his career at the time.
I think he was like 2 years older than me.
Yeah, yeah, that you arrived on the scene, and so I guess did.
And he didn't stay at Berkeley, as you probably
know. Yeah. Did Calvin was Burlingame the mass spec group person who kind of got it going for in Calvin's group?
Yeah.
So Calvin didn't have any mass spec expertise or equipment prior.
I mean, it was pretty rare in those days, and Beeman's group, which included Auer, you know, were seeding the world and the country, and Gerasi sent out a number of people to start mass spectrometry as well.
So that was a big project for Al to go ahead and get that operation functional.
But he had a big budget. He bought all these toys, this nice equipment, put it together. I think he must have been happy in the science.
Oh, yeah, that would have been a very nice position to be in, the funds to buy the equipment that you needed and
play with it.
And, well, I assume that it also produced results. There was.
I don't mean to say that he played with it, but you know what I mean. He wasn't mission driven as he might have been if he worked at Dow.
Yeah. But I mean, he was a person who appreciated the power of the tools and wanted to use them, play in the sense that he wanted to make them work to their ultimate and get a lot. I mean, Al was a very serious scientist for sure, but I mean, scientists enjoy things.
Yeah. And again, the preparing to analyze the lunar soil sample.
Yeah.
That was
my
father, of course, thinks I left too early. I moved on to my Hopkins job too early. It was 5 or 6 more years before
the lunar samples came back.
10 years maybe.
I don't remember. Yeah, it was a while. But I mean, you couldn't wait forever.
That's right.
And
Berkeley was exploding with social unrest.
So you stayed there for 2 years?
Yeah.
1 year you had to, the AAUW help you out,
uh-huh.
and the second year Calvin came into the side, well, I think we can go ahead and help us, go ahead and fund this person.
Mm-hmm.
That's nice.
Sure.
But then at the end of the 2 years you wanted to move on to something besides
a real job.
Postdocs are still kind of graduate student-ish.
Like to tell my postdocs that it's the nicest time in their scientific career because they're not responsible for raising the money, but they're also not studying for their cumulative exams or something, so they can just do the science.
Yes. The money raising part, indeed. Now you've got a pretty good set of credentials and you want to get a real job. And you've got people that are going to support you with good letters of recommendation. So,
this is the point at which Alan, you know, started the two career search, and I would then follow up on his leads, and Hopkins Medical School came through.
Mm-hmm.
So I have I was the first trained mass spectroscopist to be hired by a U.S. medical school.
Okay.
And there's a couple qualifiers in there, because I don't know what was happening in Europe. I could say U.S. The other qualifier is trained, because there had been some very interesting isotope tracer work done at Columbia by a man who wasn't trained, hadn't got a PhD, with a thesis in mass spectrometry.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, Richard Caprioli's thesis director.
Mm-hmm.
So
what, you were doing some work at Columbia?
No, I was at Hopkins.
You were at Hopkins.
But Columbia Medical School. I'm saying first trained mass spectroscopist in a U.S. medical school. You know, because there was other work done by folks who hadn't been formally trained.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a new field, and you were there on the at the time. And so it was, it had to be populated by people who weren't trained.
You kind of got thrown into it.
And of course, it was like the computer science is a new field. It wasn't so particular about who it was hired, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Cy Meyerson was always proud that he was not a PhD. And
mm-hmm.
there were, so it was in some ways easier for a woman to come into. This is one of your questions mm-hmm. in your outline. And as computer science was in its first decade, you know, there was nobody knew
right.
how to do it, so they took
yeah.
people who could teach
yeah.
themselves how to do
yeah.
it.
Yeah, you tried to apply as much logic as you had and
yeah.
your ability to comprehend the arcane
yeah.
behavior of a simple computer language.
But anyways, from Klaus's lab, from my colleagues at Hopkins, from graduating from Gerasi's lab, Robert Shapiro went to the University of Colorado at Boulder. He started the journal Organic Mass Spectrometry. I started the journal Biomedical Mass Spectrometry a couple years later. And from Klaus's lab, Sandy Markey went to the University of Colorado Medical Center. And he and I probably started the same year, so maybe I should claim I was one of the first two formally trained mass spectroscopists hired in the medical school. Thot Watson, a couple years later, went to Vanderbilt Medical School.
Mm-hmm.
And McCloskey, a couple years later, you know, started his career at Utah. You've been talking to him.
Yeah.
And Throck and possibly Jim were delayed a little bit by Army service.
Mm-hmm.
You know more about Jim right now than I do, because of you. So there was suddenly this diaspora or distribution of trained people across the
kind
country.
Kind of an explosion.
And many of us went into medical schools, you know, because medical schools saw the need, had different funding mechanisms than proper chemistry departments.
So, yeah, that's an interesting thing I hadn't thought about, is so many people did go to medical schools or get involved in bringing mass spectrometry to medicine.
Mm-hmm. Biomedical.
These medical schools were getting turned on to this by someone, or were they, what's the background?
I don't know why. I shouldn't say that, I don't. In my case, the pharmacology department wanted the support for drug development, you know, organic synthesis again, we're
mm-hmm.
talking about.
Mm-hmm.
But then they gave me the charge when they hired me to exploit mass spectrometry across the spectrum of biomedical research, which was a great job description to be given.
Yeah.
Throck Watson was hired to do one very specific thing, to use mass spectrometry to quantitate interleukins. For a senior faculty member at Vanderbilt, so he had a very tight leash compared
mm-hmm.
to me. I'm not sure what Sandy Markey was, you know, what was expected of him at the University of Colorado.
Yeah.
But he shortly moved to the NIH.
Yeah, Colorado. I'm trying to. Who was? Do you know who he went worked for at Colorado?
I think he was I don't know if he was in the psychiatry department or the pharmacology department, but Throck and I were in pharmacology departments, which is, you know, small molecules.
Yeah.
And,
well, I mean, small molecules would have been the starting point.
Sure.
I mean,
couldn't do anything. Heck, could only work with volatile things in those days.
Yeah, gas phase ions. Make it a gas phase ion. Come on.
You don't get into the gas phase.
Yeah. Please, make a gas phase ion. Yeah, that's that ultimate requirement that I think a lot of people, even I think at one time Fred McLafferty felt that that limiting requirement and the fact that the only method of ionization was at the time with electron ionization or electron impact, felt that mass spec was going to run into a wall and that was the end of it. And you know, he took that position on the East Coast with Dow Research. After he left Michigan with Dow, because he just felt that mass spec was, there wasn't much future.
Okay.
And when he went to the East Coast and ran a research operation, and of course when he got back into academia, he got back into mass spec big time. And,
well, he of course focused on resolution for when he started at Purdue. But that was still all electron impact.
And oh yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you and I would know if we plotted publications, we'd probably see a plateau.
Oh yeah.
Until we started looking at plasma desorption and that other thing, field desorption. Yes.
Yeah. Well, we went to the meetings and people were trying other ionization things. I remember, of course, there's a lot of fundamentals people doing fundamentals on photoionization, trying to get
which is still interesting.
Yeah, trying to get the energy for the ionization process refined to the last decimal point. And but still, I don't think people were doing these things, but not so much with the idea to try and develop a new ionization method, but is just to see, kind of see what you could do with it. Field ionization was an interesting technique, which I think was very techniquey. My recollection is that people either succeeded or didn't succeed
in doing
FI or FD.
It was hard. And when Lutz Grotjan went around the world and introduced it, he forgot to tell us there were a lot of extra ions above the MH ion. And in fact, if he had, we would have understood it better, and maybe things would have evolved faster.
Yeah.
But they didn't talk about M plus sodium for a while.
Yes. Okay, so you're finally settling down at Johns Hopkins, and you're giving the charter, a pretty broad charter.
Great charter.
Do they have any equipment when you got there?
When it was decided that I would go, the powerful chair of biochemistry named Al Leninger, who has written a great, very successful biochemistry book, and the powerful chair of pharmacology named Paul Talalay, wrote a proposal, for asking for an instrument, a shared, and I don't know if they called it shared instrument in those days, but asking for an instrument. They sent the proposal to NIH, they sent the proposal to NSF, and listed me as the competent person, and they were both awarded. And we took the NSF one for some reason, I don't remember. That's not quite true. I spent a year there without an instrument, because CEC practically made them to order in those days.
So
even if you had the money, it was a long wait.
So you were charged with selecting an instrument.
Yeah, I guess I got to, although I'm not even sure there was much choice. I mean, if you, you know, the MS, what, 9 wasn't quite competitive yet at that point. But I did get to become very good friends with my local salesman.
A number of dinners and whatnot. Then you wanted to go with, I guess 103 was passe for what you wanted to do, I guess.
Well, you know, we thought that the high resolution might be useful with the biological, applications, and I guess that the argument was sufficiently made to the funding agencies that that was the case. So they gave us the money to buy a 21-110 with the photo plate and all that stuff. And I just went out there. By then, Fred had moved to Purdue, and I went out and spent a week in the dark room with one of Fred's students learning to, again, to develop photo plates. And though I'd had some of that experience at Berkeley, still it was, I got. And so we set it up and started to use it. Still had a glass bulb, you know, for the petroleum industry on the thing, and I let each of my postdocs have break of the vacuum once, and the way we all did.
Oh, yes. So, now, when
the
you
big,
went...
The big advance between when I was at Stanford and when I was finally at Hopkins was we no longer recorded our spectra on photo paper. Hmm. We recorded them on the oscilloscopic light-sensitive paper. Mm-hmm. So when I talk about photo plates, it was the plates that had to be developed, but not the...
Yeah. That was the age where you had the black sleeve and
Well, that's how it was.
12 feet of paper you were trying to get into this weird slosh tank. So, now, did you have any teaching responsibilities?
Very little.
Okay.
That's the thing about a medical school. You know?
Yeah.
I did teach. I gave some lectures to the medical students, and by now we're talking about the end of the 60s, and the students were rowdy everywhere, and that was a great experience. So the very bright boys would sit in the back row and read the New York Times, not just during my lectures, during all the lectures. Uh-huh. One of them, and then I also taught a series in the. By then we had a bio-organic chemistry course for postdocs and graduate students, and I gave a series of lectures on particular family enzymes there. So there was, you know, this what still is the pattern of teaching in medical schools, of plugging in for a module in several courses, but not going through a whole course.
Mm-hmm. So you're having... a fairly small size class for the...
Well, the medical class was 100.
Oh, okay, so that's a big size class.
And the bioorganic class was, you know, often 30 to 40 people. And I think students came from the arts and science campus to take that course.
Were these undergraduate?
No, they would have been all graduate.
They were graduates,
yeah.
And were these people then going on for MDs primarily?
No, this was a course that was suitable for graduate students.
Okay. So they're trying to give them some background in the bio.
Biochemistry as a field really came into maturity during my career. I mean, so at the beginning of my career, biochemistry had gotten past the description of the vitamins, which is how it started. But it was still trying to become based in the science, in the more solid science of chemistry, less descriptive and more kinetics, thermodynamics, and principles of organics. So this was we were teaching biochemistry students about organic chemistry and graduate students about biochemistry.
Okay, so
it happened to be in the medical school because there were a group of people there who had already made the transition. Was including me by that time.
So even though your primary responsibility was to deal with this mass spec
research,
you were given some teaching responsibilities.
Sure, and I was training people in the lab too. I think from maybe not the first 8 or 9 months, but from then on, I had postdocs or graduate students in the lab.
So your equipment showed up about a year after you.
Maybe just seemed like a year. No, I think it was a year. it was a year. Yeah, and you know they trucked it from California when they finally got it made, and the truck driver would call us every night and tell us what his progress was. It was very, very intense. And then it arrived on December 23rd, and the truck driver was a Canadian, wanted to get home for Christmas, so he was in a big hurry to unload it, and drove his truck onto the sidewalk. The loading dock wasn't appropriate, but
sure.
He drove his truck on the sidewalk and crushed the sidewalk. the chair of pharmacology, who was a physician, and the third of these mentors that I should mention, told the truck driver he knew how to cure all his aches and pains, and gave him a bottle of whiskey to carry him north into Canada.
So. I'm sure you want to have a truck driver drinking this.
Well, so these days we wouldn't dare do it, would we? But yeah, so the third mentor I should mention is the chairman of pharmacology at Hopkins, who hired me. His name is Paul Talalay, and
T-A-L-A-L-A-Y.
And I believe that he was probably more Russian. Berliner was German. Gerasi was Austrian/Bulgarian.
Yeah.
Talalay was Russian.
Yeah.
But they all, came for the same reasons at the same time. Good for our country. And he was had spent several years in England on his way west, and spoke English with an British accent, and had married an English woman, and gave me lots of coaching, mentoring on science and how to present myself in public. Told me not to wear green shoes one time, and the medical school is much more family-like than the chemistry departments at Stanford or Berkeley. So he got, Talalay and Leninger got the first instrument. Talalay supported me on a department grant that he had for a couple years, and also really coached me a lot on getting started. This program project grant from NIH was reviewed after I'd been there 2 years, and Klaus Biemann was on the review committee. And Klaus Biemann said the mass spectrometry was going very well and they ought to let me write my own grant. So they did, and I got it. And so I really owe Klaus, a big thank you for pointing out that, I didn't have to be just part of the team. I could also be independent.
So he was in the process, or in the business of being consulted about grant applications.
Well, NIH, he was asked by, NIH would send out five people, I suppose, to look at how the money was being spent, and what was being produced, what science was coming out of it. And that was, Klaus was one of them,
Now, did he have any knowledge of you from...
From ASMS, probably.
From ASMS, primarily.
I think so Klaus had directed his, he'd done, his focus was on natural products, and McCloskey took the nucleotides, and like this Bob Murphy took the lipids, and somebody else, a man named Don DeJong, took the carbohydrates, nobody worked in drug metabolites or pharmacology in Klaus's lab. So he complimented me after he heard me talk and said, this is something new, this is nice new stuff. So, Klaus would never say stuff, but, So, I don't know, 6 years later, I was on a Klaus site. I went on an NIH team to review how Klaus was spending his money, and he was that was the point at which he was hiring Kathy Costello, and he'd had a fellow named Charles Hignight as his, I use the term lab lieutenant, director of the facility, or manager of the facility. And Hignight, he was going to pay Kathy less than he'd paid Dr. Hignight. And so the site visit said, there's no reason to pay the woman less. You have to pay her the same. So we also got his, in order to accommodate that, we asked NIH to increase his budget by the $300 or whatever it was. But so I, in some ways, it did, was able to return the courtesy. Klaus.
That's interesting. Now, I'm not familiar with the Hignight fellow. I guess he was, a lab lieutenant. Did he publish much with Klaus?
Probably, but this is so not only long ago, but at that time, you probably weren't following biology.
No. But I mean,
I don't know where he went. But he got a real, he got a good job.
Yeah,
probably
yeah.
in industry. He probably went to industry.
Of course, the ASMS meetings at that time were of such a size that you know.
How could you miss him? Yeah,
you knew pretty much everybody, and yes, those were the days.
Yes, those were the nice days. Uh-huh.
Yeah, I'm not sure about those. Hospitality suites that had infinitely long hours.
Well, they did away with that wisely.
Thank goodness for that. So, this guy was successful in dumping the instrument before, so he went back to Canada for Christmas.
Yes, we got it unloaded it into the building, and he went on to Montreal. And then, of course, after the first of the year, the CEC engineers came and installed it. Very exciting.
Yes, was that installations of these instruments, they have their own lives. Some of them are just, super nice, and others are super not
this
nice.
This was a super nice installation. The uncertainty I had was that it was going to be installed on a second floor, but it turned out the building was stable enough, and the elevators were far enough away, and, it wasn't earthquake prone, and so it worked out fine.
Yeah, that's normally the people like to stick these things in the basement. But
now Bob's got the mass spec lab at Hopkins Pharmacology, and it's in the basement.
Yeah.
So, as you
put them as low as possible.
Well, in that case, it's because that's the least disputed space. we could have more space in the basement than without having to fight about it.
Being on the second floor, you could have windows.
Yeah.
Which is nice.
That's absolutely
but right. Being in the basement, is the window thing's not much of an option.
And then
now you're using this equipment in its EI mode with electrical detection? Are you still doing photo plates? You could probably do either one.
Whenever you have the option, one of them becomes the default, the most popular. And so, of course, the oscillographic recorder was the method we used most of the time.
But your photo plate was a nice integrating detector. I mean, that was the primary advantage of the photo plate, was all the ions got collected, with the electrical detection.
So we set up a small dark room and, did that seriously for a couple of years.
It is, there's always that kind of like you're betting that it's going to work because you don't see anything. You don't see anything until after
you take the plate in the dark
room and develop it. And did you ever end up with plates that were...
I don't remember there being a big disappointment like that, but the plates were treacherous for a lot of reasons, so so we did eventually move beyond the plates.
It had its place in the scheme of things. It was an important tool, like you say, for super sensitive work. It's an integrating detector, so you get the advantage of collecting all the ions of all the peaks, which something to be said for that.
Yeah.
There used to be, I remember this huge battle between Beeman and the electrical detection boys at AEI, was it AEI by then? Metropolitan Vickers or whatever.
Uh-huh.
But at any rate, they were, obviously the MS-9 was electrical detection, and CEC was pushing photo plates at this one time, and I think there was this huge debater at one of the ASMS meetings where each was trying to show that his method was better than the others in terms of detection and sensitivity and all these other things. And
Klaus was pretty conservative about those things. I mean, I can remember him having heated discussions about other issues in later years. So.
Mm-hmm. Well, also he's a very strong believer in his way was the way.
I guess that's why I'd be back to serve. Yeah.
I guess that carries over from his European style ancestry, although he did, he left the European science scene because he didn't want to do the long slave labor period of the habilitation before he could become his own man. But he still... When he got here, I guess he still had some of those European tendencies that I'm the boss, I'm the big man.
Mm-hmm.
But he certainly he did an an awful lot for mass spectrometry and bringing it.
If only because he trained a lot of people.
He trained a lot of people, and he moved it beyond the confines of the petroleum industry. As far as you could take it, given the ionization techniques that he had available, you know, because of course his synthetic chemistry background was critical for that as well.
Yeah.
In terms
of
making it work, so. So now you've got this wonderful piece of equipment. What are you going to do with it?
Well, a lot of you asked me about my favorite publications, and none of them comes off with this piece of equipment. So we did try many things for many people, and I learned very quickly that I was going to be frustrated with biochemistry because there were a lot of phosphates attached, a lot of big molecules that wouldn't vaporize, you know. We did put, we introduced lyophilized rat heart. I mean, people just brought me these crazy ideas in retrospect, but at that point we weren't sure what would happen. We introduced bacteria, whole bacteria, into that spectrometer with that instrument, and as you know, that's been a theme of mine for a long time.
Yeah.
And so that, I guess, one of my papers I'm proudest of, or that would be from that series of bacterial analysis.
But that was a little bit later in your career, wasn't it?
It was in 1975 that first paper was published, and that was done on the 110 with electron impacts. And we had to heat the bacteria, and the volatile molecules were what we saw.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't proteins.
I need to pull up something here.
So but then very, very quickly, though, if that instrument came in 68... I think by about 72 or 73, the oncology's unit had bought me a GCMS. So I was already moving to integrate it to an interfaced instrument.
Okay.
And a second one in the lab.
So this GCMS instrument was, whose was it?
Well, it was mine.
But I mean, whose manufacturer?
Oh, I'm sorry. It was CEC, but it was, by then it was DuPont. DuPont bought CEC.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
It was a... it was a DuPont 321.
Was that the cycloidal puppy?
No, this was... a sector. It was a small sector.
Small sector.
Yeah, and I actually had a conversation with Bob about this morning, about whether it was a 391, a 491, or a 321. But I think it's a 321. The interface for GC had the new Beeman Watson interface. It was in this instrument. So, you know, it was state of the art, even though it was still GC, and worked for these organic compounds. We could enrich them and move them on into the mass spectrometer.
So you say the oncology people got you this instrument?
Well, it was bought with money for an oncology collaboration.
Okay.
And one of my major collaborators was an oncologist whom I always viewed as a closet chemist. He was quite a good chemist, you know, but he was an MD.
Closet chemist.
So, Michael Colvin. And we, some of my most highly cited papers were co-authored with Colvin, characterizing the metabolites of the still widely used anti-cancer drug cyclophosphamide.
Mm-hmm.
So we actually worked out the structure of the first structure of human metabolite of cyclophosphamide, and the metabolite is the one which is toxic, not the one that's therapeutic. It's a very, it's amazing that come out, got on the market and is still used, because the balance between toxicity and therapy effect is fine. Yeah. So anyway, that we had this 321 I have written here, with a GC and a Beeman-Watson interface, and then I had the good judgment to buy an Incos automated device for selected ion monitoring. You ever hear of Don Hagee at Incos?
Oh my, there's a name that's coming out of the on the background. So, how did he spell that? Don.
H-A-G-G-E was his name.
Okay.
And he founded it. He was a... And now we're beginning to talk about computers, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And he was from the Berkeley scene. I had a PhD, I don't know in what, mathematics perhaps. And one of the things that he, the computer automation devices he developed, invented, would control mass spectrometer scanning so that you could look at one. Oh, it's the old uranium story, mm-hmm. only easier.
Yeah, yeah.
The selected or multiple ion monitoring. And to skip between one mass and another without too much loss sampling time. His company was called Incos, I-N-C-O-S. Mm-hmm. He was in business for about a year, and I don't know if I was his only customer. I never heard of anybody else buying him, except Finnegan bought him.
Right.
Finnegan bought the company. And then, of course, it was no longer available for sector instruments. It was great
with
for
the quads.
Ion traps. Quads, right, quadruples. And that...
So, was it the... ASMS connection that got you hooked up with
probably.
The Incos?
I probably heard him talk at ASMS.
Yeah,
yeah.
And you saw that there was utility for having that type of...
For drug metabolism studies. They wanted blood levels, you know?
Yeah.
These oncologists wanted to know how much of this toxic metabolite was in the blood or the urine.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And
yeah.
So this gave us sensitivity because we didn't waste our time going through
uninteresting sure.
parts of the spectrum.
Yeah.
I have a picture of that device. You would laugh.
Yes. Pictures are good.
Oh, okay. For the.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Photos. I mean, these are developments that kind of were a little bit of a flash, but they were critical because they got people's attention and redirected their.
Thermo has always, in the bio applications business, Thermo has always had the edge in computer automation,
mm-hmm.
and that's because they bought Don Hagee's company and Don Hagee's expertise for a while.
Mm-hmm.
So it really did advance. He advanced the field. He worked. It's the contract that by which he sold the company to Thermo bound him to them for a couple of years.
Mm-hmm.
Then he went off and invented barcode reading for grocery store checkout.
There you go.
Which was a much better idea.
Well, I'm sure he probably got more money out of that.
Yeah, he got more money out of it.
Now you get to check out your own groceries. Yeah.
Which I still don't like to do. But
yeah.
Yeah. So that was one of the things we put together at Hopkins.
So now you got this DuPont GCMS instrument, mm-hmm. and they didn't really have a data system.
Right.
And you bought the Incos, the Don Hagee's version of Incos.
Which still gave me a strip chart readout,
uh-huh,
but
uh-huh.
It was of a single ion amount, a single ion intensity as a function of time.
Okay.
GC time.
And so it would look at selected ions.
Yeah.
And yeah, how many could you select, do you recall?
Well, I used 4 in some of my publications. I'm not sure that was the maximum, but...
And this would have been in the 19... early 70s, mid-70s?
Yes.
These aren't supposed to be linear things.
That's okay. I didn't. My notes are not linear. But, okay, so probably 75.
Okay.
Was when we started doing that work. And in Jarden, it was on your list of interest, was one of the first people in my lab to exploit the multiple ion monitoring device.
Uh-huh.
A well-referenced paper on the, quantitation of metabolites in cancer patient urine and blood.
Mm-hmm. Now, so you had the big 110, and I'm getting the impression that you were obviously being given samples that were really
direct probe.
Not really appropriate to...
Yeah.
So they weren't really in a form from which you could derive much useful information. Is that not a fair assessment of the
Well,
kind
if
of
we
thing?
Wanted a structure or a molecular weight, the direct probe on the 110 was very good.
Okay.
And if we wanted quantitation, the best data would be some a GC peak that you could integrate, or LC peak in these days. And that 110 didn't ever get interfaced to a LC or a GC, rather than probably did, but not in my lab.
Yeah.
So this simple, and the instruments are getting smaller. You know, this thing is not even as big as this table, and so we were evolving toward interfaced instruments, GCMS in this case.
And now you're going back to what you would call nominal mass or low revolving power type instruments,
But we always, with this particular drug, contained chlorines, so we had the double check of the chlorine-isotope ratio, which, well, so I monitored two ions at once for the molecular ions.
That was good.
Yeah.
And this provided a resource that was valuable to the oncologists.
Yeah, and it was fun to do new things on.
Yeah.
Fun for me to do new measurements on.
And so they appreciated your collaborator.
Well, it was really valuable to the pharmacologist. He was, because there are all kinds of oncologists, and this fellow was interested in drugs.
Mm-hmm. And that was probably, I'm just thinking that the value of that activity and that analytical approach was probably considered more successful than, say, the 110, the value of what came out of the 110 in terms of, because, I mean, the samples you got for the 110 were kind of not as well behaved.
Well, yeah, I guess that's correct. I mean, I should look at the papers I published from the 110 to see what kind of samples were. But and you will recognize that with a gas chromatograph, this instrument has even more severe limitations on volatility than the direct probe on the 110.
Mm-hmm.
So the steroid guys who've been pushy, they're wanting a mass spectroscopist was part of the reason I got the job. We always did their work on the 110.
Ah, okay.
And there was a lot of synthesis. It wasn't all...
Okay.
It wasn't human samples, as we're now moving to human samples with the integrated, with GCMS. But GC's got more limitations. So this stupid cancer drug had to be permethylated to fly at that point.
Yeah. Yeah, that was a very common approach, is to do some kind of derivatization in order to get it to fly. And those were serious chemical issues if you weren't into organic chemistry that much. I mean, it limited a lot of people in the application, because they didn't have even the minor expertise of how to do some of these things. And
so I looked for, well, first I had to find out what pharmacology was, because if I wanted to get tenure in this department, you know, and so I went to the first Gordon conference that was organized on pharmacology, got enough a sense of what it was, and then proceeded to work toward tenure. I looked for drug metabolites whose analysis was not easy, you know. So we'll be moving more now toward bioanalytical thinking, and certainly this cancer drug, which had no UV chromophore, could not be detected coming out of any kind of chromatographic separation until we used the mass spectrometer as the detector. Another class of drugs, metabolites, which was very hard to analyze at that time, were the liver hooks a lot of drugs up to a sugar called glucuronic acid, and that makes it possible to excrete them into the urine or through the urine. But and so this is a major part of metabolism, and people were usually hydrolyzing with acid or something, or an enzyme removing the sugar from the drug. But sometimes it's good to know how much of the drug is actually attached to the sugar and where it's attached. And that's the kind of stuff mass spectrometry can tell you. So we did some of that, the initial work on the 110.
Mm-hmm.
And they were pretty tricky. Well, we had to derivatize those as well to make a sugar, a carbon. A glucuronic acid fly. And then we were able to do a lot more of that work, again, derivative derivatives on the GCMS. And then, you know, you can get into business. You can start looking at urine samples and things with a good separation technique. So we did we opened up the analysis of glucuronic acids using both 110 and the GCMS. The reason I say this is because you're asking me what we did with the 110.
Mm-hmm.
But it was sort of more productive with the separation system in front of the mass spectrometer.
Yeah.
We also found we needed standards, and so we developed an immobilized enzyme method to synthesize glucuronides, which was new at that time, and a new way of doing things. And again, you're talking about the value of organic background.
So yeah.
I mean, this is enzymes, but we're also talking about bioorganics.
Sure.
So we made this new way to make standard glucuronides, and then new ways to analyze standard glucuronides. And I went, around and talked to every drug company in the country about all this because they needed these techniques.
So the research project in the glucuronides represented a whole new area of the application of mass spectrometry mm-hmm. in the biochemical environment. Of course, mm-hmm. now your organic chemistry is now getting kind of transformed into a bioorganic,
yes,
and
yes.
You're starting to teach people, so when you teach it, you learn it.
And yes. Well, and I had a colleague down the hall who was immobilizing proteins on agarose beads.
Mm.
He wasn't immobilizing glucuronyl transferase, mm-hmm. but, we learn from the environment always. And so our first paper is, in fact, co-authored with him.
So there's a lot of kind of learning chemistry involved mm-hmm. As needed to do the mass spec mm-hmm. and also to understand the bioorganic process that's going on and
sure
and, yeah so
and to open areas of research that were mine
mm-hmm.
that would meet the requirements of my career
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So you're looking at tenure.
Yeah.
Or, one, I mean, that,
or,
that's
or, a, or an increased salary, or whatever all those things we want.
Yes, the eternal goal of the academic is.
Yes.
But I mean, this approach is part of your trajectory towards that. It's, mm-hmm. It's a conscious plan on your part mm-hmm. to do that kind of thing. So that's good. If you had needed break for anything. You want me to take this? I can turn it off.
Is this the time for?
Yeah, we're back on.
Is this the time for me to tell you about for a minute about salaries at Hopkins?
Sure, that would be great.
So I was delighted to get a job, they paid me the same salary Calvin had paid me as a postdoc. They were annoyed that it was so high.
So the postdoc salary was pretty...
I didn't think so, but I mean,
yeah, I mean, most postdoc salaries aren't that high.
But it was possibly a West Coast, East Coast economic transition.
But,
so they paid me that. And then after Lyndon Johnson signed the Title IX,
mm-hmm.
and we had to start admitting women to law school and medical school, and we're supposed to have equal salaries. First of all, a lot of my classmates from Bryn Mawr suddenly went to law school, were able to go to law school. And a few of them had been able to get into medical school. But
mm-hmm.
anyways, so Hopkins Dean set up a committee to look at faculty salaries, and they put me on that committee. And the salaries were presented to us without names, but we were given the gender. And
you were not, or you were?
We were given gender.
You were given.
And of course, most of the women were lower than most of the men. There was one man, however, one point in the chart that was really out of line for a male in the Department of Medicine. And so we asked about that, and without being given his name, we were told that he was married to the richest woman in Texas. So they were naughty. so we said, you can't do that.
What's that have to do with the guy's salary?
The guy's seeing patients, blah, blah, blah. So anyway, they didn't address my salary with me in the room, but at the end of that year, without comment, I got a 25% raise.
Ah.
So I knew then that I'd been among the underpaid women. But I was loving the job, so I wasn't really complaining.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
It really is interesting.
It is interesting.
That was in 19...
Well, I can't remember the date I was on the committee, but I think when the Johnson signed Title IX in 67... I'm sorry, 70...
I can find out.
Yeah, 70 something. So this would have been in the 70s anyway.
That's not a problem. I just make a note in here to find.
Yeah, and it may be that there's a gap because I think Johnson was president in the 60s, so I may be wrong. But anyway,
yeah,
it was finally working its way through the courts and being implemented in medical schools.
Yeah, that is really amazing.
And
I like that.
And I can bracket it from my point of view, because the man that I liked so much as chair was only chair for 4 or 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
After I was hired, so it's in my first 5 years. Yeah. So it was real, you know. But anyway, so I took the money and ran.
So you were quite successful then. I mean, were you back in the position of having to go back for more grants?
Sure. Well, Klaus, as I said, told the university they had would be appropriate for me to submit my own grant.
Yes.
And I was successfully funded, and then I was off of that team grant. I mean, I liked the team grant, but anyway, I had my own.
Were these going to NIH or NSF? Or
NIH.
Okay.
Yeah, I did. We bought the 21-110 with the NSF.
NSF
grant,
money. Yeah.
And eventually, I had large NSF money again, but for the period we're talking about right now was NIH, and I've had that same grant for my whole career.
Mm.
So it's, you know, year 32 or something.
That's nice. So did the NSF have any grief about the fact that NIH, you're using
the NSF equipment? You know, their equipment grants end after a year.
Oh, after a
year.
And
they don't keep track of it.
Oh, wow.
Or feel any ownership after that. So no. We gave them a good report at the end of the year, and that was it. But then we have the responsibility to keep it running.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So
yeah.
We needed some other sort. We need some sources of income.
So were you picking up graduate students immediately upon getting on the ground? And
much as I admired Paul Talalay for his professional mentoring, he did not he did not think it was appropriate to train graduate students in the pharmacology department. So I had a lot of good postdocs. And then only when Talalay turned the chairmanship over to someone else, then that man, the new chair, initiated a graduate training program.
Okay, so that would have been a couple of years after.
And I think I probably had 3 graduate students the whole time I was at Hopkins. Mm-hmm. One of them is really has done very well since, and we can talk about him later. But I got into the real graduate business when I moved to the state school.
Mm-hmm, 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 mm-hmm. And the additional grant, did you go back for more instrument grant? I guess the GCMS was part of an instrument grant?
This is so funny. I was trying to remember how that instrument was funded, and I really do think that the oncology department paid for that. Perhaps grateful patient funds, but then I did go again and again to mostly for NIH for a while, and for instrumentation. My next big instrument was probably the MS-50.
Oh, okay.
And that was an NSF again purchased grant instrument. By that time, we had the new chair. You told me to mention difficult experiences. The new chair was a virologist, a molecular biologist. Really didn't understand chemistry, really wasn't sure he wanted it in his department, and so the chemist did not thrive, and so the mass spectroscopist got sent to the basement, and and I rebounded by getting a regional instrumentation center from NSF.
Okay.
This is the same time Mike Gross got his, and mine were the first two mass spec centers, maybe the only two mass spec centers NSF funded. We both bought one MS-50s, and that distressed the new VG company.
Yeah. There was a point that I wanted to explore, and I'm but it slipped by my brain. One of the things that I was aware of at Washington University is that there's a lot of, when it comes to buying equipment, there's a lot of money comes out of the medical school slush fund or pot of money or whatever. And so Mike Gross's approach is to you'll kind of get a good deal on the instrument and sweeten that with, he's able to pull in money from the medical school, and
yeah.
there's a lot of money. They do a lot of instrument funding with their own money, not usually to buy a complete instrument, but to
mm-hmm.
add to mm-hmm. The purchase. I was wondering if that kind of a thing happened.
Well, remember that when Mike got his and I got our NSF Regional Instrumentation Center, he was at the University of Nebraska.
Right.
I was at Hopkins, is much more sharper businessman. I won't say better, but I never had matching funds from Hopkins.
Okay.
The first time I had matching funds was here.
Okay, at Maryland.
And it was very effective, as Mike
yeah.
knows.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's at Wash U in St. Louis. That's the way almost all the equipment is funded is through
a grant with a little piece from the university.
A significant help to
uh-huh.
show that the university is committed to helping the thing along. So
yes.
I think that probably helps the granting agency in terms of.
But anyway, this MS-50 was not, and that was not my experience at Hopkins, nor is it Bob's experience at Hopkins.
Okay.
And so I'm very mystified about this instrument appearing from according to my to my notes.
Where did it come from? Well, maybe you need to go back and research that and find out. It obviously was an instrument that you used, and somebody had to pay for it.
But there was so little fuss that, for me anyway, in getting that one. So we moved on to the basement of the MS-50.
So what did that mean, moving? Well, did you get rid of the 110, or
yes.
did you retired it?
We gave it to another lab.
Okay, and this would have been, how long did you actually use it?
Okay, so probably at least 10 years.
Okay, so it had a useful life.
A good run. Yeah. But by then, detection technology, and
sure.
we were beginning to get automated computational data processing, and it was but it was a beautiful piece of stainless steel and the kind of thing physical chemists love.
It had a nice appearance. The thing I liked about it was, I mean, it wasn't something that impacted my existence, but when you know that you could pull the module forward and lay them down to get into the electronics. I mean, whoever designed that instrument layout was smart
uh-huh.
in terms of the fact that, hey, we're going to have to maintain this thing someday.
Yeah.
So let's make it real easy to get to instead of burying it inside.
They're so compact now that.
And this was, I thought it was a brilliant idea. I don't think anybody's ever done anything like it since.
That's
which
a very interesting point.
Yeah. It was nice that way, and it never really impacted my life, but I just was impressed by the fact that it was such an easy instrument to get into when you had to replace. Well, you didn't replace, I guess you could replace transistors in that instrument, but not anymore. You replaced circuit boards. And
there might have been even some tubes in that instrument.
I think probably there were, particularly on the high voltage side.
Yeah.
You must have certainly had tubes. Yes, did you ever get bit by that machine?
I was almost disappointed I didn't, because there was that old club, the pride of being scarred, and Budger Kevitz had his scar from running hitting a high voltage source in Europe, but fortunately that club has died out, so I never got.
That's probably just as well.
Shocked.
But you did break vacuum.
Yeah, yeah.
All
that glassware on the at the inlet side.
Yeah. Those were interesting pieces of equipment for sure. So you got rid of the 110, and were you able to keep your GCMS equipment?
I think we didn't. We didn't move it either. We moved on to an LCMS.
And down to the basement.
Yeah.
Because politics mostly, right? I mean, the new chair didn't think he wanted to.
He went to put a molecular biologist in our second floor space, our space with windows. Yeah. So that would have been about 1978, 79, mm-hmm. and again. It took a while for the MS-50 to arrive after we ordered it.
Oh, yeah.
Also made to order, and I think they flew it across the ocean.
Yeah. Now, did you go to the UK to look at the equipment?
Bob went,
okay.
By that time, we staff, the NSF Regional Instrumentation Center, together because you needed, you remember that Nebraska, they had Charlie Wilkins, and even Gene Futrell.
Mm-hmm.
So you needed more than one person. And he came on board at that time, and he got to go to England.
Those were fun trips.
Yes and no, you know, Manchester.
Yes, right. But basically he went to check out the gear. Yes. And I mean, was there a competition, any serious competition? Was CEC trying to...
CEC had been bought by DuPont.
Oh, DuPont,
and DuPont,
yeah,
went out of business by then.
That had become a kind of a strange thing.
They closed. A fellow named Ed Chait tried to make a success of mass spectrometry for DuPont, and they had such a high profit margin requirement. You know, they wanted 15% profit, and if you only got 13%, they close you down.
Yeah.
But anyway, they shut it down. So the choices then were, Finnegan was making quadrupoles. And,
right.
The high resolution and high mass instruments were made by the English companies. I don't even know what JUL was making then.
Well, there was also Matt in Germany.
Ah,
but
Matt.
They had a... I don't know what they had at that period, but I think they probably had something that was trying to get competitive on the high resolving power side.
I can't remember that they ever had something like... So Hank Fales had an MS-9.
Mm-hmm.
We got this... His was from AE. Yeah, okay, it's AE. Right. I don't remember anybody besides... VG as being in the competition for that selection.
Okay, so it was not so much a competition as this is what we need. Can you do it?
AEI had split by then into Kratos and VG.
Okay.
And we bought the Kratos MS-50.
All right.
You know, Brian Green had left and Sid Evans stayed.
That. That whole...
Too many good engineers.
Yeah.
So the competition was between the two English companies. And we bought the MS-9, and Mike bought the MS-9, and...
Okay. All right. So
MS-50.
All right. So VG had come into existence out of the AEI shop.
Yes.
And that was the competition. Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm. Oh, yes. Yeah, Brian Green is an interesting fellow. I really always enjoyed meeting up with him, and he's still smoking away and burning away.
He's one of that 1%. And he's a sir, isn't he?
I don't know.
The Order of the British Empire?
I don't know. It could well be. I should know. You know, I went to the UK to interview John Bynum and... Keith Jennings, and I really wish I had the foresight to go ahead and talk to Brian Green and while I was there, and also Bob Bateman. Bob Bateman's retired, apparently. Mm-hmm. So all those guys are really sharp people, really amazing sharp people. So I don't know. You want to take a break and get ready for lunch one way or the other?
Sure, we should eat even if my guest doesn't show up.
Push the stop button.